From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Paul Auster discusses his new novel, The Book of Illusions. It's about a professor of literature whose wife and children die in a plane crash. After several grief-stricken months in an alcoholic stupor, he refocuses his life by writing a book about a forgotten silent film star. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Cunningham, author of The Hours, talks about his new book, Land's End, A Walk in Provincetown. It's the first in a new series of books in which writers are asked to discuss the place they most like to return to. And TV critic David Bianculli comments on the TV commemorations of September 11th. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration has put the nation on high alert of a possible terrorist attack connected to the anniversary of 9/11. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Officially, the nation is now at orange, the second highest level on the color-coded National Terror Alert chart. That's one step up from where the country has been since the warning system was put in place. The move is based on information gathered from a former senior al-Qaeda operative. President Bush says the potential targets of attack are not known.
We have no specific threat to America. But we're taking everything seriously, obviously, and so therefore we have gone to a different level of concern, different threat level, which means our government will be providing extra security at key facilities and that we'll be increasing surveillance.
The administration says Americans should be extra vigilant but not change their plans for the coming days. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
German police raided business offices and homes near Hamburg today looking for links between a trading company and a man suspected of recruiting terrorists for the September 11th attacks. Officials said Tatari Designs and the Tatex Trading Company were run by a Syrian-German family whose members knew the September 11th hijacker, Mohammed Atta. They said one of the company's employees, now being held in Syria, may have introduced Atta to al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan. Prosecutors said the company may have been used as a front for money laundering and making counterfeit documents for use by terrorists. On the eve of the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, the Saudi defense minister said his country was deeply saddened by the attacks. He said the 15 Saudis among the 19 suicide hijackers had done great harm to his nation. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Qatar.
Saudi defense minister Prince Sultan said the September 11th attacks brought pain to all humanity. In remarks published by the Saudi press agency, he said the men involved in the attacks had abandoned Islam and nationalism. Those who claim they are Saudi have fought their own country before anything else, added the prince. He said Saudis had no feelings of hatred towards other people, be they Christians or Muslims. Prince Sultan's comments are among the most conciliatory by the kingdom since the attacks on September 11th. Saudi-U.S. relations have been strained due to the large number of Saudis among the al-Qaeda hijackers. Saudi Arabia did not publicly admit until February that its citizens had taken part in the terrorist attacks against the U.S. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Qatar.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 83 points, or almost 1%, to close at 8,602 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained 15, or 1.1%, to close at 1,320. This is NPR News. Public health officials in Illinois have confirmed another death caused by the West Nile virus. They said the victim was a 78-year-old Cook County man who died from West Nile encephalitis. That brings the state's death toll from the mosquito-borne illness to 11. Officials say there are now 292 confirmed cases of West Nile disease in Illinois. The first stage of the trial of Slobodan Milosevic will end tomorrow after 7 months. The prosecution has sought to prove the former Yugoslav president is guilty of war crimes in Kosovo. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from The Hague.
Europe's biggest war crimes trial since World War II will adjourn tomorrow for 2 weeks before the prosecution begins its presentation of the Croatia and Bosnia parts of the trial. The prosecution has called 124 witnesses in open court, and several other so-called protected witnesses were heard behind closed doors to guarantee their safety. The last prosecution witness was military expert Philip Koo, whose testimony was aimed at showing that the chain of command of all armed groups in Yugoslavia led directly to then-President Milosevic. Milosevic, who is acting as his own lawyer, is accused of 66 counts of crimes against humanity and genocide in the Balkan Wars. The trial has been interrupted several times because of the defendant's poor health. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, The Hague.
Switzerland joined the United Nations today, becoming the 190th country to join the World Organization. The Swiss resisted joining the UN for more than 50 years, fearful of undermining their historic neutrality. The decision to join came after a national referendum last March. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Paul Auster. He was described by Washington Post book critic Jonathan Yardley as one of our most inventive and least predictable writers. Auster's novels include Timbuktu, Leviathan, and the New York Trilogy. He wrote the screenplay for the film Smoke, and he edited the NPR National Story Project anthology, I Thought My Father Was God, which has just been published in paperback. Auster has a new novel called The Book of Illusions. The book's main character, David Zimmer, is a professor of comparative literature at a college in Vermont. The book begins in the aftermath of personal tragedy. Zimmer's wife and two children have died in a plane crash, and his grief is so all-encompassing he can no longer function in his old life. After several months in a blur of alcoholic stupor and self-pity, he tries to refocus his life by writing a book about a forgotten silent film star named Hector Mann, who vanished mysteriously in 1928. After its publication, Zimmer gets a letter from a woman named Frida Spelling, who claims to be the film star's wife. She insists that Hector Mann is still alive and would like to meet Zimmer. Zimmer has no idea if she's telling the truth. Here's a short reading.
We all want to believe in impossible things, I suppose, to persuade ourselves that miracles can happen. Considering that I was the author of the only book ever written on Hector Mann, it probably made sense that someone would think I'd jump at the chance to believe he was still alive. But I wasn't in the mood to jump, or at least I didn't think I was. My book had been born out of a great sorrow, and now that the book was behind me, the sorrow was still there. Writing about comedy had been no more than a pretext, an odd form of medicine that I had swallowed every day for over a year on the off chance that it would dull the pain inside me. To some extent, it did. But Frida Spelling, or whoever was posing as Frida Spelling, couldn't have known that. She couldn't have known that on June 7th, 1985, just 1 week short of my 10th wedding anniversary, my wife and two sons had been killed in a plane crash. She might have seen that the book was dedicated to them, for Helen, Todd, and Marco, in memory. But those names couldn't have meant anything to her. And even if she had guessed their importance to the author, she couldn't have known that for him, those names stood for everything that had any meaning in life, and that when the 36-year-old Helen and the 7-year-old Todd and the 4-year-old Marco had died, most of him had died along with them. They had been on their way to Milwaukee to visit Helen's parents. I had stayed behind in Vermont to correct papers and hand in the final grades for the semester that had just ended. That was my work, professor of comparative literature at Hampton College in Hampton, Vermont, and I had to do it. Normally, we all would have gone together on the 24th or 25th, but Helen's father had just been operated on for a tumor in his leg, and the family consensus was that she and the boy should leave as quickly as possible. This entailed some elaborate last-minute negotiations with Todd's school so that he would be allowed to miss the last 2 weeks of the second grade. The principal was reluctant but understanding, and in the end she gave in. That was one of the things I kept thinking about after the crash. If only she had turned us down, then Todd would have been forced to stay at home with me, and he wouldn't have been dead. At least one of them would have been spared that way. At least one of them wouldn't have fallen 7 miles through the sky, and I wouldn't have been left alone in a house that was supposed to have 4 people in it.
Thanks for reading that. That's Paul Auster reading from his new novel, The Book of Illusions. Paul, can you talk a little bit about creating a main character who has lost so much that he's nearly dead himself, and he certainly is no longer the same person he was before?
I think in some peculiar way, this book is a product of my own aging. I noticed right around the age of 50 that something started to change inside me. Your body begins to break down, which is, of course, inevitable and a great sign of your impending mortality. But at the same time, at that point in your life, or at least in my own case, so many people that I've loved and who have loved me are now dead by that point, that you find yourself talking to ghosts a good part of the time, you know, living with the dead as much as with the living. And I think somehow this book reflects that change that's slowly taken place in me.
And I imagine that you wrote at least most of the book before September 11th, yet there is this kind of strange resonance with it in the sense that, you know, he's lost his family through a plane crash. It wasn't through terrorism. It's just an accident.
Right.
But still, the images he has of losing family in this crash resonate with the images that so many Americans have now.
I know. It's true. The book was finished about 3 weeks before September 11th. And it was just so eerie on top of everything else to realize that I had written a book in which people die in the way that so many others had died in the real world that terrible day last year. But one could say that the book is about grief and about how one man slowly tries to put himself together. Grief is a subject that we don't like to talk about very much in America and in the Western world. Not anymore. You know, in the old days, widows and widowers would wear black for an entire year. It was a public recognition of the sorrow that people were feeling. And now we're supposed to pick ourselves up and get back to normal within a few weeks or at the most a few months. And I don't think it's possible. Grief takes a tremendous toll on the mind and also on the body. And I'm sure we all know people who have literally died from grief, and it happens every day.
Now, your main character in the novel is an academic, and after losing his family, he throws himself into writing a book about Hector Mann, a former silent film star, a minor silent film star. And he says, "My outward purpose was to study and master the films of Hector Mann, but the truth was I was teaching myself how to concentrate, training myself how to think about one thing and one thing only. It was the life of a monomaniac, but it was the only way I could live now without crumbling to pieces." I'm wondering, have you ever been through something like that in your life where you took on a project to just have this focus that would take you away from what it was you were really thinking and feeling?
Well, I have to say, in a funny way, I think my whole life has been spent that way. Writing books is an obsessive activity. And once you are in the midst of writing a novel, it's as real as the tangible things around you. And I think anyone who's written will understand that. At the same time, Zimmer's situation is very intense, because he is in such terrible shape. But I would say, in my own experience, perhaps writing The Invention of Solitude, my first prose book, was written under circumstances similar, in that my father had just died, my marriage had just broken up, and I had absolutely no money. And writing that book was the only thing that kept me going. And I attacked it every day like a maniac, I think.
Well, the book that this English professor in your novel throws himself into writing is a biography of Hector Mann, a former silent film star. He was known as Senior Slapstick, the South American heartthrob with the comic touch. Describe this silent film star that you've created.
Well, you see, actually it wasn't a biography that Zimmer writes. It's a study of Hector's films.
Good point, yes, right.
You see, Zimmer is crushed with grief, as we've said. And he's been drinking a lot. He's holed himself up in his house. He's not seeing anybody. He's gone on a leave of absence from his teaching. And every night, he kind of camps out on the sofa in his living room, watching television and drinking scotch. And one night, he's just surfing channels, and he stumbles upon a documentary about silent film comedians. And he sees a little clip of Hector Mann in one of his films. He's never heard of Hector Mann. He has no idea who he is. And yet, there's something about that little scene that makes him laugh. And it's the first time he's laughed in 6 months. And he realizes that if he has the ability to laugh, maybe there's something more than just death inside him. And arbitrarily, he decides to go around the world and look in film archives at all of the 12, 20-minute films that Hector made during the course of his brief career. And Hector vanished after 1929, and everyone presumes he's dead. But Zimmer doesn't care about that. All he wants to do is look at the movies and as a way to keep himself busy. And looking at the movies leads into a project to write a book, which keeps him busy for another 9 or 10 months. So it's an escape from himself. And yet, in Hector's humor and humanity, I think Zimmer starts to find something, some consolation for himself.
As your main character, Zimmer, researches the life of this silent film star, did it give you, Paul Auster, the chance to do silent film research? In other words, are you particularly interested in silent films?
Oh, I have always been interested in silent films, particularly silent comedies, which I think in some amazing way have not dated very much. I mean, we can still watch Chaplin or Keaton and laugh our heads off. Everything is very clear and understandable. It's the language of the human body. And the body is always the same, whether it's 50 years ago or 100 years ago, we can understand it. And the fascination is that this form, the silent film, is dead. It's not practiced anymore. And yet these people, the great ones, mastered the language of silent film so that it nevertheless, even though it's deader than the deadest Renaissance painting as a form, it still speaks to us today. And I've always loved that work. And even as a young man trying to find my way in the world, there was a moment when I actually sat down and wrote scripts for silent comedies when I was about 19 or 20. Don't ask me why, but I wanted to do it. And those manuscripts are lost now, and I wish I could find them. I wish I knew where they were. It would be fascinating to look.
It was an interesting exercise for you to create this fictional silent film star and then create an entire body of work for him.
It was, for me, an amazing adventure because in the book, as you say, many of Hector's films are described, and some of them in quite exhaustive detail. Now, the thing about what you would call a written film is that, on the one hand, you have to put in a lot of visual detail so the reader can actually see what's happening. But at the same time, the prose has to move along at a certain speed to mimic the experience of watching a film, which is charging at you 24 frames per second. So too much detail and everything would bog down. Too little detail and you wouldn't see enough to experience it as a film. So I had to do a lot of juggling and rewriting to find what I felt was the proper balance between the two.
My guest is writer Paul Auster. His new novel is called The Book of Illusions. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Auster is my guest. His new novel is called The Book of Illusions. In addition to writing the book about the silent film star Hector Mann, the academic in your novel, Zimmer, is translating a work by the French writer Chateaubriand. I'm going to ask you an incredibly stupid-sounding question, which is, was Chateaubriand a real writer, or did you make him up?
No, he was a real writer.
Was he? And,
oh, yes. He's a okay. classic French writer and such an interesting person.
Now, is this terrible that I've never read him?
No, see, because Americans don't really know about him.
The name was familiar, but I thought maybe that's
it's
the name
a
of
steak.
A wine.
It's a steak.
Oh,
it's
a steak.
It's a
okay.
cut of steak, and he's one of the few.
I don't even know the food, let alone the writer.
That's right. He's one of the few writers to have a food named after him. Chateaubriand was a major writer of the 19th century. One of
oh,
the great.
Oh, stop saying he's so major. It makes me feel
and,
worse.
But also, he was a politician, and he's probably the only man in the world who met both George Washington and Napoleon, because as a young man he came to the United States and wrote some brilliant work about the U.S. and discovering Niagara Falls. I think he's the first person to describe it for a European audience.
Well, now that I know that you didn't make up Chateaubriand,
right.
I assume that also means you didn't make up the story of the odd backstory of His masterwork, which took 35 years to write, but he didn't want it published until 50 years after his death?
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Explain the story of that. I thought this was something you created.
No, I didn't make this up. This is fact. Chateaubriand, as we were just saying, took 30 to 35 years to write the book. It's called Mémoires d'Outre-Tombe, which means Memoirs from Beyond the Grave. Zimmer, my narrator, comes up with an interesting alternate title, Memoirs of a Dead Man. Now, Chateaubriand didn't want to publish it during his lifetime, but he was running out of money. His mistress was Madame Recamier, you know, the most famous beauty of the age, who appears in many paintings from the period. She came up with an idea to form a kind of business, create an association of partners who would, number one, pay off Chateaubriand's debts, number two, give him an annuity while he was working on the book. And so this was arranged. It was a brilliant stroke. The problem is that Chateaubriand kept on living. Everyone thought that he was about 60 when this arrangement was made, but he lived to 80. And so most of the original partners had sold their shares in the book to other people. And by the end of his life, Chateaubriand was literally owned by a bunch of strangers who wanted nothing but for him to die so that they could finally publish the book and recoup their investments. It's one of the strangest publishing stories in history.
Because the characters in your novel include a professor who's a writer, a filmmaker who makes movies, and a writer who's written this great text, there's all these, like, stories within the story.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of... And there's lots of other characters who have their own backstories in this. So there's lots of stories within stories in your novel, lots of stories for you to come up with. And you love telling stories and writing stories, and that's even usually a part of what your work is about, is storytelling itself.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering, you know how, like, some musicians say that, you know, melodies just come to them? Like, do stories come to you? I mean, do you just, like, live with a mind and that's always giving birth to these stories?
It's true that they bubble up inside me. I don't know where they come from. I've actually never been able to track the genesis of an idea for a story. It's so mysterious. One minute, it's not there, and then you blink, and something is there. And you don't know where it came from. And it's so odd that often with the stories, of course, come the characters, and with the characters, their names. I think in almost every instance when I've invented a character for a novel, he or she has been born with the name, which I never change. It's just there. It's as if they're real people, and I've suddenly found out about them. It's crazy. Just a crazy business.
And do you realize that not everybody is wired that way, that not everybody else receives stories?
I suppose so, although having worked on the National Story Project for 2 years and received over 5,000 submissions from people all over the country. I would think there, nevertheless, I'm convinced that there are a lot of people who tell stories very well. And even if people don't write them, they like to tell them. And whether they're true stories or made-up stories, I think storytelling is a fundamental part of being human. If we didn't tell stories, I don't think we would have any clue about what the world was. It literally organizes reality for us.
And did you find that as when you were young that you needed to read other people's stories?
I loved to read as a child. I think every writer begins as a reader, someone who falls in love with books. You feel, as a young person, that living inside a book is better than being inside the real world. And you just love being there so much that you decide at some point that this is what you want to do with your life. You want to make books because the experience of books is so wonderful.
Paul Auster, his new novel is called The Book of Illusions. He edited NPR's National Story Project. Its anthology, I Thought My Father Was God, has just been published in paperback. Auster will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Discovery Channel, presenting a documentary based on the New York Times series, Portraits of Grief, Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on the Discovery Channel. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness, and Peace by Jack Kornfield, author of A Path with Heart. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When asked to write about his favorite place, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Cunningham chose Provincetown on the tip of Cape Cod. Coming up, he tells us why. Also, critic David Bianculli comments on TV documentaries commemorating September 11th, and we continue our conversation with Paul Auster.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Auster, author of the new novel, The Book of Illusions. His other novels include Timbuktu, Leviathan, and the New York Trilogy. He wrote the screenplay for the movie Smoke. He also edited NPR's National Story Project and put together its anthology, I Thought My Father Was God, which has just been published in paperback. The book collects stories from NPR listeners that are true but defy our expectations of the world. I know you talked about this a little bit with Linda Wertheimer, but I would just like to ask you again about, as we approach September 11th, some of the reasons why you think we have this need to keep retelling the story of the 11th over and over from every possible point of view.
I think when people go through trauma, and certainly we in New York and everyone in the country, but particularly in New York, have suffered this great trauma of loss. I tend to think of what happened to New York as a big family tragedy. Very few people were untouched by it. And in order to come to grips with something so monumental, silence really is not the answer. You have to keep talking about it. And as Salman Rushdie was saying the other day on the air, that everyone was telling everybody else what had happened to him or her on that day. And there was this deep need just to tell. And the accumulation of all those stories becomes in some way the reality of the experience for us. Because it wasn't private. It was a communal event. And we have to talk to each other and hear what each of us has gone through in order to get some sense of the totality of the experience.
Have you ever reached the point of thinking that you can't hear any more of the stories, that you need to withdraw into silence and be alone with your thoughts?
Well, it is true that you can only take so much. And this week is a very terrible week in New York. There's so much going on, both in public and also through the media, that I find it almost unbearable at this point. As we approach the 11th, I think more and more people in New York are just going to start breaking down and crying all over again. It's a horrible memory, and we had to be so brave in order to carry on. And I think with the distance of a year, suddenly emotions are going to begin coming out again, and it's going to be pretty tough to take.
There's a lot of television shows, and there's going to be more, that are replaying a lot of September 11th footage and video. And it's hard to figure out where the line is between we need to see this again to commemorate the event and to tell each other again what happened and how horrible it was. A fine line between that and feeling like, well, this was great footage, so we're going to show it again. It was really dramatic, so we're going to take it out of the archives and show it again.
There is a kind of mercenary aspect to the media. After all, everybody but NPR is in the business of trying to make money, and so there is an edge.
And I'm not intending to remove NPR from.
No.
We don't have footage per se, but we do have sound. So
of course.
I can include all of us in this. I don't mean to exempt us. Anyways, go ahead.
But, you know, the thing is, I find myself unable to watch television. More and more, I just am unable to. And I'm not planning on looking at TV during this week. The images are so strongly burned into my head already, I don't need to revisit them. I don't think I want to. But talking to other people, listening to what other people have to say, that I can take, and reading also. But all those highly dramatic and tragic images are just too much. I know them too well now.
I want to get back to something that you were saying about storytelling, about the importance of telling each other stories. And I know in my life I sometimes feel that I'm overloaded and I don't have room for more characters, that I've said this to people who have like new TV series and they have like a pilot introducing new characters, and I feel like I'm busy. I don't have room for you in my life. And then, of course, the characters win me over if it's a good show, and then I want to watch it. But you know, there are so many stories coming at us now through movies and television and radio and books. And, I mean, we could spend our whole lives living in other people's stories now. I wonder if you think about that much, about how we live in a society where the stories don't stop.
Well, I think it's very important. Obviously, people don't absorb everything. They have their favorite genres and media that they go to. Some people like to read comic books. Other people like to watch television. Some of them like to read novels. But all of us, I think, need to live inside fiction as well as the real world in order simply to understand the real world, not just as escape and entertainment, but as a real grappling with what it means to be human. And books in particular, I think, are a place where books are a unique place in the world, because I believe a book is the only place where two strangers can meet on absolutely intimate terms. And there's something absolutely irreplaceable about that relationship between reader and writer. And I think when a writer opens himself up or herself up to the reader and the reader is receptive, something very deep happens. And no matter how many times people predict the death of the novel, I don't think it's ever going to happen because it's an irreplaceable experience.
Have there been certain movies, books, or music that you've turned to in the past year that really spoke to you because of the events of the past year?
You know, it's funny. I have this old recording on a record, a vinyl record of Hermann Scherchen, the great conductor, doing St. Matthew Passion. I think 8 sides, 4 discs. And I've been listening to it almost consistently throughout the entire year. I can't get enough of the grandeur and humanity and simplicity all at once of that great Bach piece. So I don't know if you're familiar with that recording, but it's amazing how much emotion the singers are able to put into their performances. Movies, I've tended to gravitate towards the simplest, most humanistic films. Things by masters like Renoir or Rossellini or Satyajit Ray, Ozu, the simple movies about simple people and what it means to be human. No tricks, no fast cutting, no special effects, just human stories. That's been very important. And also, I should say, comedy has been important to me as well. Just getting that sense from some of the great old Hollywood film comedies of how life goes on. You know, that's what comedy is all about. Tragedies occur, and yet life goes on. And comedy reminds us of this, and I think it's very important not to get lost in our own depression right now, but to think about how to go on and how to make the world a more livable place for everybody.
Well, speaking of not getting lost in our own depression, I mean, how do you avoid not getting lost in your own depression when you're writing a book like your new one, The Book of Illusions, that's about somebody who is depressed nearly to the point of death?
But you see, for the writer, living through these experiences while he's writing the book, there's something cleansing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Plunging into the depths of these emotions is not depressing. It's invigorating in some way. You go down so deep that you're beyond suffering. You're just trying to tell the reality of the story. So it wasn't for me a depressing experience to write the book.
You think that your novel was inspired, in fact, in part by being in your 50s, because having lived this long, so many of the people you know or knew have died, and you feel that you're often having conversations with ghosts. As you mentioned, you know, in your 50s, your body starts to change. I'm wondering if when you were young, you had certain thoughts about the adults in your life who were already in their 50s or over and how they dealt with those physical and emotional changes of aging, and if the thoughts you had about them are affecting the way you are dealing with the fact of your own aging.
Well, the funny thing is, to be quite blunt about it, I don't really think I thought about it. I wasn't paying attention to what the 50 and 60-year-old people were going through. I was, you know, an adolescent or a 20-year-old, and I was trying to live my own life. When you're 20, you know you're going to die. That's absolutely certain. But you don't know what life later on is going to feel like after you've lost so many people who've been so important to you. It's something you can only learn through experience. And now that I'm having these experiences, it seems almost every week somebody else is disappearing. It affects you. And you know at this point in your life that certainly there's a lot more behind you than ahead of you. And this also changes your perspective on things.
And is it making you depressed?
No, I would say I'm not really gloomy about it at all.
Why not?
I'm just trying to get the most out of the time that's left to me. I hope it's still many years, but I can't bank on that at all. And every day becomes more precious than the one before. And you know, there's this great desire to do the work that I feel I have it in me still to do, and to you know, take care of the people I love as best I can. And to just appreciate the miracle of being alive. Just a month ago, my wife, daughter, and I were in a horrific car accident. And the car was demolished. We were blindsided by a speeding van not far from our house in Brooklyn. And the impact of that collision, you know, is still with me, you know, reverberating through my body. It was a nightmare experience. And we should be dead. And when I saw the car afterwards, I don't know how we got out of there alive. You know, we should be dead, but we're not. And it's just another reminder about how things can change in an instant, how precarious and unpredictable life is. And it's just reminded me all over again that I'm just so lucky to be breathing still. And I want to go on breathing as long as I can.
Paul Auster. He edited NPR's National Story Project in its book, I Thought My Father Was God, which has just come out in paperback. His new novel is called The Book of Illusions. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Cunningham talks about the place to which he most likes to return. This is Fresh Air. Crown Books has started a new series in which writers describe a favorite place, a place to which they like to return. My guest Michael Cunningham has written the first book in the series. It's called Land's End, A Walk in Provincetown. Cunningham won a Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Hours, which has been adapted into a forthcoming film. Provincetown is on the tip of the Cape Cod Peninsula in New England. In the summer, it's overpopulated by vacationers. Cunningham says his favorite time there is from Labor Day until Halloween. He first went to Provincetown 20 years ago for a writing fellowship. Now he has a home there and alternates his time between Provincetown and Manhattan. In his new book, he says that when he lived in Provincetown year-round, he tended to become irrational toward the end of October, when one beautiful day after another seemed to imply that the only reasonable act was to abandon your foolish plans and fall to your knees. I asked him to describe what makes Provincetown so beautiful.
Provincetown is on a narrow spit of land. You can from the third floor of a building, you can see salt water on both sides, the open ocean on one side and the bay on the other. It's 3 miles long and two streets wide. Out at the very tip of Cape Cod, sufficiently thrust out into the ocean that the light there is more or less what the light is like about 50 miles out to sea. It has a kind of clarity and a volatility. It changes sometimes from minute to minute.
You have a description of Provincetown I'd like you to read. It's on page 61.
Sure. Provincetown has always been an eccentric sanctuary, more or less the way other places are bird sanctuaries or wild game preserves. It's the only small town I know of where those who live unconventionally seem to outnumber those who live within the prescribed boundaries of home and licensed marriage, respectable job, and biological children. It's where people who were the outcasts and untouchables in other towns can become prominent members of society. Until recently, it was possible to live there cheaply and well, and it's long been possible for, say, two men to walk down Commercial Street holding hands and carrying their adopted Peruvian baby without exciting any unusual degree of interest. It has been attracting refugees, rebels, and visionaries for almost 400 years.
How did it become a place for artists, and how did it become a kind of gay-friendly place?
It became a haven for artists about 100 years ago. It started as a fishing village, really just an aggregate of little shacks kind of built wherever on the sand, and the only people who lived there were people who fished or hunted for whales. And then around the turn of the century, with the rise of the big cities and industrialization, before the turn of the century, really, toward the late 1800s, artists began to flee from the cities and to search out places that were still natural, that were still particular unto themselves. The Impressionists were doing it in France, and American artists, to somewhat less famous effect, were doing it here. And Provincetown was one of the places they started to go. The fishermen and fisherwomen were mostly a sort of ribald and eccentric lot themselves, and were not at all averse to the idea of somebody moving in and setting up an easel. And it went on like that, and it seems to have culminated around the beginning of World War I, when suddenly an artist couldn't move to Paris anymore. An American artist had to stay in America. And so there was this huge influx of artists to Provincetown. Eugene O'Neill, prominent among them. That's where he wrote his first plays, which were performed there. He lived there for almost 10 years. And that really established it as first a sanctuary for artists, and then I think by implication, a place where you could just live in relative freedom, whether you were an artist or just a crackpot or an oddball.
You've described Provincetown as a place of eccentrics and weirdos. Who are some of the more interesting eccentrics that are kind of regular fixtures of Provincetown?
Yeah. There's a woman who worked at the post office who, I'm sorry to say, has retired, but she was a poet. I don't think she ever published, but she wrote poetry and loved people who wrote poetry. And if you were sending a poem off to submit it for publication, you would tell her that, you know, maybe there's a poem in this envelope. And she would say, fine, thank you, and very discreetly, when she had a moment, take it to the back of the post office where no one could see and slip it down her shirt and press it to her bare breast for luck before sending it on. Plus, at the little airport, there's always a jigsaw puzzle in progress, which anyone can just add a few pieces to while they're waiting for their flight.
Is there anything about the younger generation in Provincetown that's reshaping the community in ways that you don't quite comprehend? Or don't quite get.
I mean, I think it's the job of younger people to behave in ways that a 49-year-old novelist can't quite comprehend. The younger people, who were more numerous a few years ago, did hugely inventive things with drag. There was a night, which is still occasionally revived, which was a drag show. Anyone in town could be in it, but you had to dress in drag, whatever drag is to you, and you had to sing, no lip sync. You had to sing a rock and roll song. And the whole town showed. It felt like the whole town showed up.
Not happening anymore?
No, no, no. There is still a thing called Showgirls, a more traditional drag event that involves lip sync. And I actually, a brilliant friend of mine who's not there anymore, who moved to San Francisco, asked me if I would do one with him. Now, I don't look. I do not look good in a dress. You know, think Mamie Eisenhower. It just it doesn't work for me. So I said, well, you know, I have no objection to doing drag, but I don't know if I can bear to look so ugly. He said, no. I actually want to do a duet between Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel. I'm Kate Bush. You're Peter Gabriel. And we did, and we were, I have to say, sensational, and won first prize. It was the same year I won the Pulitzer, and I am proud to say that while every year they give another Pulitzer Prize in literature, I'm the only one to have won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature and Showgirls in the same year.
And this would never happen outside of Provincetown for you.
No, no place else.
Michael Cunningham, his new book, Land's End, has just been published. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on September 11th, documentaries. This is Fresh Air. The imminent anniversary of the September 11th attacks has brought with it dozens of new TV documentaries to mark the occasion, as well as a day of programming tomorrow that will involve the vast majority of broadcast and cable networks. TV critic David Bianculli has some thoughts on this subject, beginning, he says, with the realization that he doesn't know what to think.
Here's the way criticism works, at least criticism in my opinion, and that's what I'm supposed to be certain about. In my case, because I'm a television critic, I'm supposed to react to what I see. I put it in context, point out what I think it did well or did poorly, and basically say whether or not I think it's worth your time to watch it. That's where your trust in me comes in. If you agree with me a lot of the time, then maybe you'll tune in to sample an Alias or a 24 or a Buffy the Vampire Slayer, even if you might not have beforehand. On the other hand, if you disagree with me most of the time, then anything I'm really excited about, you know to skip. Either way, as long as I'm consistent, I can serve as some sort of barometer and be useful to you as a critic. But with this 9/11 coverage, I don't know how you can trust me, because I'm not sure I even trust myself. Last year, when the attacks happened, my job was to watch all of it unfold, on 11 TVs at once, each tuned to a different network, and report on what I saw. I saw so many things so many times that you'd think I'd become numb. Instead, I became raw. And when the first documentary special started to arrive a few months later, with firefighters and other rescue workers and survivors telling their stories, they all touched me deeply and got rave reviews. Well, it's a year later now. Already, I've seen lots of documentaries about the towers falling, the surviving family members coping, and the colleagues recalling. Tonight, there are two more major ones. On PBS, America Rebuilds takes a month-by-month look at the rescue, recovery, and excavation efforts at Ground Zero. And on ABC, Report from Ground Zero, based on the book by Dennis Smith, interviews firefighters and family members about what happened at the World Trade Center 1 year ago tomorrow. With a lot of these specials, I'm able to watch and judge them just as I would any other documentary program. The writing is a little fuzzy here, the music is too sappy there, and so on. But every once in a while, a show comes along that kicks me in the gut and makes me cry and strikes all these chords that shake me right to the core. Tonight's Report from Ground Zero is one of those shows. because the unseen interviewers do such a great job getting these people to talk frankly and very naturally about their own memories and emotions. A lot of the talk is about multiple generations of firefighters, with fathers losing sons, sons losing fathers, and brothers losing brothers. It's the loss that does it to me. And here's where I don't know if I'm reacting as a TV critic or just reacting. A year ago, when the Twin Towers were leveled, I was dealing with some loss of my own. My father and stepmother had died recently and suddenly a few months before, and my marriage was unraveling unexpectedly after 25 years. So when this firefighter father talks in Report from Ground Zero about his missing firefighter son and going home each night to face his young grandson, I don't know if it shakes me out of simple empathy or something deeper, but it hits me hard.
I hated going home. I hated going home. I hated it. Hated it. Did it. Went down a block. 1,000 people. You know? Grandson came out. Said, "Do you have Dad?" Told him no. I said, we'll find him. It wasn't the scenario. And that was a day that I lived for like 2 more weeks every day with my grandson. Because when I got home every day, he would come out happy. Didn't see Dad. He would ask, "Did you find him?" I say no. And I guess, I don't know, maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks, he stopped asking.
As for tomorrow, when just about all the networks are going wall to wall with commemorative coverage, I don't know what to tell you about that. But if I'm sure of anything right now, it's that people's reactions to September 11th and what they want or don't want to watch on TV a year later are intensely individual. Watch what you want. Avoid what you must, react however you do. It's your call, and I can't be your guide.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Discovery Channel, presenting a documentary based on the New York Times series, Portraits of Grief, Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on the Discovery Channel. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness, and Peace by Jack Kornfield, author of A Path with Heart. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We've produced a special edition of Fresh Air commemorating September 11th with words and music. We'll feature performances by singer-songwriter Richard Thompson and jazz singer and guitarist John Pizzarelli, and a reading by Sekou Sundiata. Join us.